G'day, everyone. Quick message before we start. What we're trying to do with this podcast is to help people better understand their mind and how it works and give people practical strategies they can use to maintain and improve their mental health. Would you consider helping us to continue to do that with a financial contribution, large or small? If so, thank you. Just follow the link in the show notes. All donations $2 or more are tax deductible. G'day, welcome to Minding Your Mind, all about your mind, how it works, mental illness and mental health. As always, I'm with Professor Ian Hickey, psychiatrist and co-director of the Brain and Mind Centre at the University of Sydney. So recently I had a sore knee and it was a bit injured, which meant I couldn't play touch footy or run for a few weeks. And I so much hated it. My stupid knee was stopping me from doing some of the things I really love doing, good for my health, good for my mental and physical health. Imagine how much worse it might be if you get a diagnosis that you have a severe mental health condition, depression, anxiety, OCD, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, especially if it's one you're going to have to learn to manage and live with possibly for a long period of time. I didn't react very well when I found out my knee had a problem for a few weeks. How do you adjust if you discover you might have a problem with your mind? So that's what we're talking about today. And we're joined by Jofi Dahan, who's a psychologist. She's pursuing her PhD in medicine and health, focusing on early intervention in youth mental health. She also works at the Brain and Mind Centre in youth mental health and technology, is a pastoral care member of the university's Human Research Ethics Committee and a non-executive director of Lived Experience Australia. Jofi was diagnosed with bipolar disorder at the age of 25 after living with the condition undiagnosed for 11 years, since the age of 14. Hi, Jofi. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Now, firstly, can we start with before you were diagnosed with bipolar disorder? We do want to focus today on what happens after that diagnosis, the grief, if you like, and the tumult it might cause you. But how did that first manifest when you were a teenager?
So there are kind of two stages for me before diagnosis. Mm. There's the period when I was younger up until 14 before I became unwell.
Yep.
And at 14 when I did become unwell. In my earlier years, I was a high achiever. I was a duck at school. I was a musician. I had great relationships. Everything was wonderful. I was accelerated through school. Life was great. At 14, my mental health deteriorated. I started to develop severe clinical depression. I had low mood. I found it hard to be motivated. Everything felt like walking through thick sand. Things that once were very easy to do became really, really hard to do. I would cry for no reason. I had suicidal ideation every day and I thought that was just normal. My condition between the ages of 14 to 25 progressed over time. Initially, it looked like depression.
Mm.
And then I hit my kind of around 20 and I started to develop severe problems with concentration, attention, those types of things. And it was considered by my psychiatrist at the time that I had ADHD. As a result of that, I was put on stimulants, so dexamphetamine, Ritalin, those types of things, which we now know can also contribute to triggering the ups for people with bipolar right. as well. And so I hit 25 and basically between 14 and 25, I deteriorated. I couldn't complete my education. I kept failing at uni. I couldn't hold down a job. I damaged relationships. And by the time I got diagnosed, I was admitted to hospital and everything had fallen apart in my life.
So in those 11 years, there were not a lot of, well, I don't know whether you see the diagnosis as inaccurate and wrong or just not quite uncovering the full story, and whether you feel, you know, upset, even angry at the fact that your bipolar disorder wasn't diagnosed earlier, or alternatively you see that the people who are trying to diagnose you were kind of just trying to put together the fragments they could see in a coherent way and almost understand. Where do you sit on that?
A bit of all of those, really. Mm. I think in many ways I Yeah, I was angry that it had been missed.
Yeah.
I had been seeing psychiatrists since the age of 14. So there was plenty of room for intervention, but I also appreciated that, especially something like bipolar disorder, it doesn't look like bipolar disorder initially. It can look like depression. It can look like anxiety. It is progressive. So there was some understanding for me around the complexities of diagnosing a condition like bipolar while also still feeling a huge amount of anger and sadness that it had been missed. I think for me as well, the other thing was that we have bipolar in my family. So I felt that given there was an awareness that it's there, and we all know that there's a strong association genetically for bipolar, that that got missed as well.
Right. And you know, you were aware and that was disclosed to the doctors at the time.
I was aware of
the bipolar in your
family.
Yes,
absolutely. Yeah. Okay. Absolutely.
So when you got diagnosed with bipolar, I guess you've been diagnosed with several things prior to that. So,
yes.
You know, perhaps initially you weren't sure whether this was the right one. What did it take for you to think, right, they've got it this time?
It was several things. So previously I'd been diagnosed as a child with OCD. I got diagnosed with generalized anxiety disorder when I was in high school, major depressive disorder and PTSD. None of the interventions I'd been trying, the medication, the therapy, anything helped. Nothing helped at all. And I think by the time
Did you get false positives where maybe something looked like it was helping for a while and you thought that we've got it, but it actually, you know.
Absolutely. Mm. My first hospitalisation was when I was 17 for depression, and that's the first time I was put on an antidepressant. And initially it helped, but I kept kind of snowballing. The biggest thing for me was I wasn't able to function. Between that 14 and 25, I really struggled to function.
Yeah.
And so getting diagnosed with bipolar, by that stage, I'd developed hypomania. I'd developed that euphoria, that high energy, that agitation, that irritability, and it was clear as day at that point that I had bipolar. Right. I really, that picture fit, and it made sense because of the genetics in the family.
I'm just curious, you know, when you're, for example, 17 or 18, if the mania wasn't manifesting then, is that right?
Yes.
It was more the lows. I'm no psychiatrist, but it must have been hard to back then diagnose you with bipolar without the ups.
Absolutely. But, you know, that's a really common story for young people who do have something like bipolar.
Yeah.
It doesn't look like, you know, the DSM or Diagnostic Statistical Manual criteria of what bipolar looks like until it's quite advanced.
Right.
And that's one of the biggest issues we have now in terms of identifying it early on so that effective treatment can be there at the right time.
See, at least when I hurt my knee, it looked like my knee. Like, I didn't think it was my ankle. And that's one of the really difficult things, isn't it? It can look like something else. Okay, so you got diagnosed at 25 with bipolar disorder. You know, when I was thinking about your story, I think, wow, relief. But really, you've talked a lot about grief. Was it both?
It was grief for me personally. I know it can be relief for some. I think really fundamentally, whether it's grief or relief, comes down to the meaning that you make of it. For me, it felt like a life sentence. Mm. I'd spent the last 11 years of my life going from being a high achiever to not being able to read a page, to write a sentence, to get myself out of bed in the morning. And so when I got a diagnosis, it was like, is this what I have to live with for the rest of my life?
Right. So you didn't think, great, we've got it, now we can treat it. You just thought, oh my God, it's going to be like this.
Absolutely, yeah. That it's a life sentence and that, you know, fundamentally we are how we think and perceive the world and our emotions and things like that. And I knew that this diagnosis or this condition for me now meant that for the rest of my life I wouldn't have full control over something that made me fundamentally who I was, which is my brain, that I was not the one in the driving seat. So for me, getting diagnosed, I only had the years that I'd experienced already of deterioration to project forward in thinking what the rest of my life would be. I'd also seen bipolar destroy lives in my family. And so that was another thing that influenced me as well, going, gosh, I saw my father, you know, be significantly impacted. And that's what's going to happen to me with my career, with my education, with my relationships. Mm.
So before we talk more about the grief, which is essentially what this episode is about, how you react and when you get a significant mental health diagnosis. Ian, you've been quieter than for a longer time than I've ever heard, been in your presence and haven't heard you say a word. Any thoughts on what Sophie's told us so far?
We're going to thank Sophie for taking the time to explain so elegantly the prior period when diagnosis isn't really working, then arrival. I was thinking about your knee.
Thank you.
When you have a knee, I've hurt my knee. I know why I've hurt my knee and I expect to go in a few days. If I turn around and say, oh, you know, James, your knee, actually it's due to an underlying bone cancer. Then you'd stop.
Yeah.
Go, oh my God, cancer, will I die? Is my life threatened? Is it changed? And I think Sophie's tapped into, which is hard for people to understand.
I mean, could it be? I'm worried. No, go on.
It happens all the time.
Yeah.
Someone goes wrong and has an x-ray.
Okay, don't talk about that. No,
but you can imagine the suddenly, unexpectedly. Now, Sophie's alluded to something else, which unfortunate in her situation where the thing's already known, but you already have an experience. So, for example, take another example. Let's say families where there's commonly breast cancer. And someone says, I have breast cancer, but they've already had a mother or an aunt who's had breast cancer. Then they've an idea.
Yeah.
And if that's gone badly. Now, of course, in the mental health world, in previous generations, most people have bad experiences. Most people don't have experiences where the treatment of that in their parents or their grandparents went well. So we've got this double problem. It's a serious thing. It's not just common anxiety, depression. You're not going to fix it. It's serious. As Jovi so elegantly said, it's about me, my mind. It isn't something I can actually detach myself from. And my whole life trajectory, because this is mainly happening to young people. Most mental health problems start in that teenage youth area. Mm-hmm. This whole life trajectory issue. So I think we often, and the point of this episode, is I think we often underrate the impact of that and the wish that it were not so. And therefore, the rest of society at times joins in with, oh, no, it doesn't really exist. No, you don't really have that. It's all fine. It won't really happen. And yet the person finds themselves, hang on, I've been in this for a decade already. I've seen it in my family already. Just trying to say it isn't a problem ain't going to help.
Mm.
But coming to terms with how important it might be, given prior experiences, given what I think, given what I'm not at all sure that this can be well managed, is a real stop, almost as if you had a cancer diagnosis.
Mm. Sophie, is it helpful to think of, we've talked about grief, this, you know, analyse your reaction to your diagnosis of with bipolar at the age of 25 in terms of the five stages of grief: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. Do they kind of make sense?
Absolutely. Certainly denial was an element at first, you know, the maybe it is just depression, you know, maybe I'm just overwhelmed, maybe it's stress, and very much a this can't be happening, you know, another thing now. In terms of denial, that was those factors were big factors.
And did they last? Because what denial can do is to prevent you from getting proper treatment because you're denying there's a problem that needs to be treated, right? Did that happen?
Not for me. I've been very lucky that I've always sought treatment and complied with treatment, which I think is why I've been able to recover so well and manage my life so well. I think a big one for me was anger, which is a classic part of the five stages of grief. And it was, why is this happening to me? Why is there another thing? Because often what you find with people with complex mental illness, there's a lot of things that have already gone wrong in their life, be that they've had stresses in their life or their condition has actually impacted their life. So there's a strong sense of it being unfair, of there being something else again. Mm. The biggest part in terms of five stages for me was actually around despair and sadness and hopelessness of the diagnosis.
Can I just go back to the anger and totally understand that? I mean, you know, I was angry about my knee and that's a tiny problem. What do you do with the anger? Like anger, I've always thought anger is just so useless, but that's not really helpful because it comes and it's there, but it never really helps you achieve much, does it? I don't know. You might disagree.
No, it's very true. I think working with the anger is about acceptance and sitting with it. And there's a lot of things when you're diagnosed with a mental illness that You can't solve it. You can't take away your illness. You need to learn to sit with some of that distress, and anger is part of that distress.
You need to accept it, don't you? Like, yes. I mean, it's very easy to think it's not fair, why me, and all that, and I'm so angry at the fates or whatever for giving this to me. And I can think of that about my knee, and anyone can think it about anything. But the sooner we accept that it's happened and work out what to do with it, the better, isn't it?
Yes, but you can't rush the process. Mm. And with those five stages, people can shift back and forth between them. Anger can be a really, you know, often in society we think that anger is a bad emotion or a bad experience. It can actually be really helpful.
Can it?
Absolutely. One of the things for me, it drove me to go, I'm going to overcome this, or I'm going to work really hard to take my treatment seriously, to comply with my medication, to manage my life, and I'm going to show it that it's not going to beat me.
Yeah, great.
So in some ways, initially, it kind of actually helped propel me through my recovery.
Yeah, yeah. I've never really understood bargaining as a stage of grief. Did it make any sense to you, the bargaining?
I think with bargaining, it's very much about if I do this, then maybe, you know, this higher power will kind of let me off the hook or make something good happen. That's a stage that I didn't really go through. And I think that's the thing we need to consider when we think about the five stages, is not all five stages apply to everyone. Mm. The experience of grief is not the same for everyone with a diagnosis, and you can shift back and forward.
And the last two, depression and acceptance.
Those two have been the biggest ones for me.
Yeah.
Depression for me, there were so many aspects for it. Loss of the future I thought I would have. You know, for me, even through that 14 to 25, I kept sticking at trying to finish my undergraduate degree. I kept sticking at working. I never gave up. I had plenty of people tell me just, you know, it's too hard, you keep failing, that type of thing. But I kept going. And, you know, for me, the depression part of that is, I guess, around, you know, is the rest of my life going to be that hard? Mm. Am I going to be able to function the way I want to? Am I, you know, part of the depression is, who am I now? What is my identity now? Am I my mental illness? Is it something I live with? Is it who I am? Because it controls my mind. So there was loss. When we think of despair and sadness and grief, it's to do with loss. So it's loss of the future I thought I would have, loss of my sense of self. For me as a female, it was also around potential loss of an ability to have a family, not because my diagnosis precludes me biologically from having children, but because I questioned, am I going to be able to parent a child with this condition, which I most certainly can now that I'm well and stable. But in those early times, again, like I said earlier, all you know is that this has destroyed your life and that's what you're going to live with. The other thing with the despair side of the grief is it feeds into the condition. So when you have a depressive episode, it can exacerbate your grief. So the depression is like a state. And then the depression has this way of morphing and sometimes making it about something. So then you think that I'm just low because I'm really down about the fact that I've been diagnosed, when in fact you're having a depressive episode. Similarly, the stress of going through a grieving process, that psychological process, that stress can have physiological changes on the body that also affect your clinical depression as part of your condition.
Right.
So there's that relationship there.
Of all the five stages of grief, acceptance sounds by far the best one.
Absolutely.
How did you reach that and when?
So as you mentioned, I was diagnosed at 25. I would say I was in a grieving process for 3 years. Interestingly, that was also the period of time it took to optimize my treatment.
And by treatment, I mean, you know, it's a private matter, but are you able to give any details?
Absolutely. So treatment has several things. Monitoring is one of them. So for me, I see my psychiatrist fortnightly. Mm. She just checks in and makes sure my sleep is good, you know, my energy levels, my mood. We just kind of check in. And if we need to make any adjustments to my treatment plan, we can do that regularly. Another part is medication. bipolar is a physiological illness. It's no different to cancer. It's no different to diabetes. It's not psychological. It's a physical medical condition that requires medication. And so getting the right combination of medications, which is different for everyone. You know, I know plenty of people with bipolar and we all take very different combinations of medication. And then self-management has been huge. So I've been really privileged to have a psychiatrist who's on the forefront of all the research in this area. And we now know that bipolar is what you'd call a circadian rhythm disorder. So simply put, that it's influenced by your body clock and the changes in that clock and the stability. And so I self-manage through getting exercise, light at the right times of the day to kind of stabilize that clock in simple terms.
Right, early in the morning.
Early in the morning, first thing in the morning.
Yeah. Yes. You've walked here.
So doing those things has given me my functioning back. I haven't had a major episode in 5 years. I am now achieving all the things. I'm back to being, I had a friend say to me, Shofi, you're like the 13-year-old self when we first became friends. You're back to being yourself again. I feel like myself again. I've learned that I can do anything I want to do with my life again, but I had to get on top of my illness. And now that I know I can live a meaningful life, I love my work, I love my studies, then I can do that.
Which, talking about your work, which you may not have found had it not been for your experiences, I guess, given your work in the mental health field.
It's certainly an element. I had an interest in it because of the family history.
Right.
That first piqued my interest in the area. And then certainly having my own diagnosis, pursuing that career provided a sense of meaning and purpose.
Yes.
Because I wanted to help other people's lives and to live it. My PhD at the moment is about helping people get diagnosed at 14, 15, for example, not until their life's been destroyed and they're in their mid-20s.
Yeah.
So, you know, absolutely. And I would say as well that I'm very privileged in that while I never bring my own experience directly into my practice as a psychologist, the empathy I've developed, the ability to identify early warning signs actually makes me a better practitioner.
Another record silence from Hickey. Any thoughts?
Oh, yeah. It's always better to let Sophie talk. One of the issues you raised, James, I think you did what all parents and practitioners do is, couldn't you? Well, diagnosis, great. So now we know what's wrong. Can we move immediately to acceptance? Can we move immediately to compliance? Can we move immediately and now move on? And what's the problem? As Sophie just articulated, you know, that 3-year process of finally getting it right, okay, we got it right, but actually being able to live with it, the psychological reaction to that. You were dishing anger. We had a whole episode on anger. I don't know how it could be a productive thing. I'm with Sophie on this as a motivator. But of course, if you're the practitioner or you're the parent or you're the partner, you want the person, and you see this, I say, like in other areas like cancer. Okay, cancer, get the treatment, just accept it, move on. The psychological response to these things that really cause us to stop. Everybody else wants to move on. Mm-hmm. Everybody else wants you to do whatever the doctors say or be compliant or find out what is happening. You know, the individual response to that is much, much more complex.
Yeah.
And people do get stuck. It's great in Jovi's example to get good care, which remains sadly rare. But even then, to take quite a while to get to the point of going, okay, how do I readjust my life projections to do that? And our systems, our health system certainly doesn't take account of that. Hence why young people were keen that we do this episode. Mm. But also often surrounding people who really matter, practitioners, family, carers, intimate partners, they just want to move on. Just accept it. As if the grief bit never happened. Don't get angry. So I think this kind of trying to facilitate the process.
Yeah.
There is a grieving process, particularly going to affect young people. There is great uncertainty and it's going to take a while. And the complex thing that Jovi just described of the, is this my psychological response to the diagnosis or is it the illness itself, that kind of vicious cycle of the two, is complicated. So there's a whole, I think, facilitating the psychological process, you know, as in facilitating grief. The whole point about facilitating grief is allowing it to happen. You know, as we've discussed before, I hate Anglo-Saxon funerals. I love Latin funerals where people wail and demonstrably come together and recognize grief in collective ways. Whereas we have this kind of like, please suppress it. Please don't be angry. Please don't be distressed. Please don't be anything. So as if that will help. But there's a need to express it. There's a need to recognize it. There's a need to kind of, and I think explore with different people, with young people, What are they thinking? What do they think it means? Zsofi Way is a really interesting one. It's the second time in the last 24 hours that a young woman's raised this with me, is that issue about child rearing. Not can I have children, but what sort of parent will I be?
Mm.
You know, that's not the sort of thing that immediately jumps into my head when I think about diagnosing someone with bipolar disorder. It's not top of my mind. But for many young women, it will be. Not is it possible? Clearly, it's biologically possible. And with good care, it's certainly possible. But the one about that – so whatever it is that's really in a person's head, will they be able to maintain a relationship? You know, how will my partner react? Like what other things are going on? So I think we just don't take enough time to consider all those factors.
So there may be someone listening to this who has just received a major mental health diagnosis, maybe at age 16 or 26 or 46 or 66. What advice specifically around that grieving, moving to acceptance period would you have for them?
I think fundamentally it's about looking at your diagnosis and shifting the meaning from my life is over to my life can still have meaning and purpose. And there are ways to do that. So the first thing is you need to get well. You need to seek out care. You need to comply with your treatment and you need to never give up. Keep going. People will say you're too unwell or this isn't working. Keep going. Keep seeking and believing that you can achieve the things you want to achieve in your life. I would like to think that I'm a testament to many young people that if you get effective care, that anything's possible in your life. You can feel like you again. It's not a life sentence. It's no different to someone that's diagnosed with type 1 diabetes in their 20s. They're very, very sick. They end up in hospital, but they get the right treatment. And yes, they have to manage their condition for their life, but it doesn't stop them from having relationships, to pursuing those career. But they needed to take a pause and get on top of their health.
But I'm presuming your psychiatrist, when you were diagnosed with bipolar disorder, may not have said those exact words, but would have said things to the effect of, this is good news, now we know we can, there are effective treatments, you can live a good life managing this, we'll just have to find out the best way to managing it, the best medication, the best behavioural strategies. And yet, you said it took you 3 years to kind of get through the grief process.
There's a lot that goes on in terms of treatment that's very medical focused and
yeah.
needs to be, but your psychiatrist or doctor doesn't help you manage all those other areas of your life that are being impacted by your condition. So for me, even though I knew that we were on the path to the right treatment, it didn't help me navigate the other things I was going through at the time. For me, the other thing I learned, which did provide a strong sense of relief, I'd had a lot of physical health issues from being an adolescent onwards, which we now know is extremely common in bipolar because it affects most of your organ systems, which a lot of people don't know because they think it's just psychological. And I remember my psychiatrist sitting down with me. I think it was our first or second appointment, and she showed me this picture of the brain and how the condition could affect the different organ systems. And she explained why I had all these different physical diagnoses previously that actually stemmed from my bipolar. That gave me hope.
Right.
Because it explained things
yes.
that I knew could make a difference. But the thing with mental health is it's a lot more complex to get right. It takes longer to find that treatment, to optimize that. Mm. You need to experience that you can have a life of meaning and purpose. A doctor can't give you that.
Yeah.
They can help you towards it. You have to find it yourself.
Let me ask you about autonomy, even with my pathetically trivial example of my knee. When it blew up, I was like, oh, I've just got to wait. Then I went to this great physio and he said, the more his five exercises, the more you do them, the quicker it will get better. And I immediately felt empowered. I felt then a partner in my own treatment, and I did them heaps, and it really worked. Often with any medical condition, and particularly something that requires a medical, at least a partially a medical solution, like bipolar disorder, we can feel that it's happening to us. Was it important? And Ian sees autonomy as being one of the two pillars of with social connection of good mental health. being able to get some autonomy, being told by your psychiatrist or finding out for yourself that these are the behaviors, you know, you don't really do the medical stuff, you just swallow the pill, but being able to do the behavioral stuff, the circadian rhythm and body clock stuff, yourself can make a difference, and that became empowering and helped?
Absolutely. So much of a focus of my life now is self-management, and I don't see it as a negative now. I see it as, you know, it's like taking a vitamin every day. It's just part of my routine. I've integrated it. And I couldn't have done that without the psychoeducation that was provided by my psychiatrist. And so, yes, absolutely empowering, because it gives you a sense that you can't take away that you have the illness, but you're back in the driving seat more. You're exactly steering the way that it goes. I know that I need to manage my stress, manage my sleep. And I've been doing all of that for 5 years now, and I've been incredibly stable and incredibly well. So, yes, I feel that I play a key role in my trajectory in terms of my life and my health now, which is supported by the care team around me.
Yeah. You will have only spoken 3 times in this podcast. Any final thoughts?
The autonomy, self-management bit, that's critical. Diagnosis can be paralyzing, as if you're just going to become passive. And the more serious the diagnosis, the more passive. So this is, again, true. The type 1 diabetes is an excellent example, or cancer care. It matters what you then do.
Mm.
And so I think when you said, you raised an interesting thing, James, about what did the psychiatrists say when they say something like bipolar disorder or schizophrenia or OCD, that we need to be careful about what we say, that we're then saying, yes, it's very serious and there are medical aspects. However, it also, this is what it means for you, what is possible with you, the explanatory thing. So I think the danger is we chuck diagnoses around and go, oh, well, you've got bipolar disorder, so you'll have to take lithium, so you have to do this, and kind of that's kind of it. We don't really unpack that. So diagnoses can be empowering if done well, but they can be disempowering. And I think that's why people react against the so-called medical models or clinical models or whatever, because they feel disempowered by that. And then need also, how are people likely to react? I do want to pick up the naming of things. I think it's very helpful to call something what it actually is, if it is bipolar disorder, so that people can find out more about that and to avoid sort of generic terms just like mental disorder or complex mental illness or something. No, this is what it is and this is what we know, and you can find further research and this is the strategies that are available. Or if it is schizophrenia, or if it is OCD, or if it is anorexia nervosa, name it. A lot of work we did with a lot of destigmatization. A lot of people who are from the non-world of mental health go, oh, we should make up new names. We'll remove the stigma by removing the name, or just calling it stress or anxiety, depression.
Right.
Doesn't help.
No.
It's confusing.
Yeah.
Nearly everyone who's ever had a serious mental illness says, tell me what it is, best you can name it, so that I can find out more about it, happening.
I would have been really irritated if I went to the physio and he said, you have generalized leg disorder.
He said you got a sore knee.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Zone in on it as specifically as possible.
Well, so he needs
work out what it is.
Exactly.
Meniscus problem.
Exactly.
And then how to fix it.
But also that physio was smart. Here's the 5 things you need to do, James.
Good on you, Drew.
What Zofie's alluding to, I think one of the other things that Zofie said really importantly, what's the purpose in life? That's not defined by the psychiatrist, the diagnosis, anything else. What's the purpose in life? And of course, like any serious medical diagnosis, the purpose in life often is a great focus then. Okay, if I get a really serious diagnosis, what are the things that really matter to me that I'm going to seek to achieve?
Yeah.
So not to be not just disempowered, but also not to be disengaged from life because of the diagnosis. It leads to the opposite. A real need to focus on how am I going to be most engaged despite the fact that I have this new, you know, challenge in my life.
Shofie, thanks so much for coming in. That was amazing to hear your story and your articulate way of describing those difficult times, and some great kind of messages for people who might be going through something similar. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions, comments, suggest further topics, send us an email, mindingyourmind2, mindingyourmind, that's numeral2@gmail.com. Minding Your Mind is supported by the generous philanthropic donations from families who support ongoing research into youth mental health. Our book, Minding Your Mind, is out. Ian's book about depression, The Devil You Knew, is out. Further help is available from Headspace, Beyond Blue, Head to Health and Lifeline. Google them. You can call Lifeline on 1311 14.